Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review for August 31st, 2015. We will begin today's reading with news from the local pages, World War II Pilot's Bracelet Finds Way Back. Starts with a photograph of two gentlemen. Caption is, William Haynes left and Michael Reynolds researched genealogical and military background information on local World War II pilot Robert L. Hawkins for the Veterans Assistance Commission of Macon County, Inc. Hawkins was killed in action in 1945. From Decatur, this article by Tony Reed. The kindness and determination of a stranger 4,500 miles away is the reason the last trace of a Decatur war hero is finally winging its way back home, 70 years after he was killed in action. First Lieutenant Robert L. Hawkins was just 19 and the veteran of an incredible 74 combat sorties when he was attacking ground targets near Eberbach in southern Germany in March 1945. His P-47 Thunderbolt fighter-bomber appeared to have been hit by ground fire, and Hawkins lost his battle to land the plane, plowing into a forested area and dying at the controls. Around his wrist had been a golden identity bracelet with Bob Hawkins in Gothic script on one side and his service number on the other. That is the final trace the pilot left behind in Germany, along with fragments of his plane, which still litter the forest floor to this day. Klaus Deschner is a German who grew up near the crash site and is the man responsible for recovering the bracelet and returning it to Decatur. The body of the fighter pilot had returned home long ago. He was buried in Germany at the time of the crash, which came just a few months before the war in Europe ended, and his remains had been disinterred by the U.S. military and shipped back to Decatur in 1949. His late father, Guy, who in 1945 had been presented with his son's posthumous Distinguished Flying Cross Medal awarded for gallantry, had him reburied in Graceland Cemetery, where a simple marble plaque marks his second and final resting place. Deschner is a technical worker at a software company and a volunteer firefighter who, in his spare time, has the unusual hobby of locating and documenting World War II aircraft crash sites in Germany. The former home of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich offers a rich hunting ground, and Deschner says there were more than 25,000 plane crashes from all nations in Germany during the war. He has documented and researched some 280 of them, but the Hawkins crash has always held special significance. He explained in an email interview that his father had been an eyewitness to the crash, and Deschner had started researching it 17 years ago, but had never been able to discover the name of the pilot. But after reading an article about my hobby 2 months ago, a young man called me saying he knew the name of the pilot, said Deschner, 53. The young man's grandfather was at the crash site 3 days after the crash and found the bracelet. Since then, the bracelet was in the possession of his family. Bracelet in hand, Deschner had the pilot's name and could start tracing him. His inquiries led him to contact Herald and Review managing editor Dave Dawson, who passed him on to Kathy Paulus, superintendent of the Veterans Assistance Commission of Macon County. Paulus dug up some background information on Hawkins, but put out an appeal for research help that was answered by William Haynes, president of Decatur's Korean War Veterans Association, and Michael Reynolds, a genealogist with the Decatur Genealogy Society. I asked for help, and these two guys just go nuts finding out about Robert Hawkins, said Paulus, 55. They've done so much work. Hawkins' life had ended long before the Korean War, but Haynes, for his part, was intrigued and touched by the story of the young flyer and wanted to find the details of his military service. I didn't want this to be a case of, oh, he went down over there and nobody cared, said Haynes, 76. We care. He didn't know Reynolds had answered the same call for help until the two of them bumped into each other at Decatur Public Library and discovered they were researching the same topic, Hawkins. I am glad we were able to find out about him, and now that item, the bracelet that has been lost for so many years, is finally being returned, says Reynolds, 74. It's a good feeling. Here's the researched curriculum vitae for Hawkins. He was born April 7, 1925, in Decatur, and lived at 1081 West Macon Street. He attended Woodrow Wilson Junior High School and Decatur High School. He worked for Fisher Grocery Company before the war, and he entered the then U.S. Army Air Forces in April 1943. By February 1944, he had earned his wings and was commissioned as a second lieutenant at Spence Field, Georgia, one of the youngest fighter pilots in his class. He was shipped to the European Theater of Allied Operations in July 1944 and saw extensive action in Italy and southern France. A Decatur Daily Review story on February 21, 1945, said the now First Lieutenant Hawkins had flown his 50th combat mission and had been involved in dive bomber sorties destroying enemy rail operations and other crucial targets. 2 months later, on his 75th combat mission, Hawkins' luck ran out. A Decatur Herald story of April 4, 1945, reported him as being killed in action in March. The family he left behind included parents Guy and Mabel Hawkins, a twin brother, William, serving in the Navy, and brothers First Lieutenant Guy Curtis Hawkins, Jr., an instructor at an airfield in Kingman, Arizona, and Corporal Jack K. Hawkins, serving in India. He also had a sister, Rosalind, of Hollywood, California, and two stepbrothers serving in the military, and a stepsister living in Decatur. A search today for any living blood relatives came up empty, but Reynolds did find Denise Malios, who, along with her late husband Thomas, had been very close friends with twin brother William Hawkins, who died in 2002 at 77. In William Hawkins' obituary, the Malios couple and their children and grandchildren are described as adopted family. William was like an uncle to my children and our very dear friend, said Denise Malios, who lives in Decatur. He told us his brother had been shot down in Germany, and it was obvious he was very proud of him, she says. Bill was a wonderful, awesome man, and I am sure his twin would have been similar to him. His death so young is such a shame. She says she will be happy to receive the bracelet on behalf of the family and to keep it for a while until a permanent home is found for it or a blood relative comes forward. Back in Germany, Deschner, who is married with two children in their 20s, says returning the bracelet to Hawkins' hometown marks a kind of closure and a symbolic act of remembrance. He says the young Decatur pilot is emblematic of a whole generation decimated by conflict. The pilots and crew were young guys at the beginning of their lives, and they had to leave their lives for something as ridiculous as the war, he says. I don't want them to be forgotten. And another article from Tony Reed from Decatur. Wisconsin zoo visitors on trail for tips at Scoville. Miniature vampire deer might be just the ticket for Ochsner Park Zoo in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Decatur's Scoville Zoo already has two of them. The knee-high critters with heavy-duty inch-plus fangs are actually tufted deer from Southeast Asia. And they caught the eye of Ochsner Park Zoo manager Alice Schellenberger, who stopped by Scoville Sunday to shop for ideas. Schellenberger and her zoo specialist, Tori Spinozzo, were on a weekend whirlwind tour of zoos that included three in Chicago and then a dash down to Decatur before heading back home. They were looking for inspiration and tips on exhibits they can use to enhance their two-acre facility, which features 16 species ranging from black bears to wolves and capuchin monkeys. One thing Scoville Zoo has that Ochsner Park would dearly like to have is accreditation with the American Zoo and Aquarium Association. Zoos that make the grade have to meet high standards of animal care, exhibit display, and educational outreach. Dave Webster, Scoville Zoo curator and assistant director, said accreditation swings open cage doors and makes it easier for zoos to acquire animals from other zoos. It's a kind of good housekeeping seal of approval, Webster said. Getting accredited is a very big deal, and I know our Baraboo visitors want to talk to us about how we got that done. Spinoso, 42, said Ochsner Park sees some 40,000 visitors a year and has big plans, including an otter display that will cost $300,000. And we think those tufted deer might be an option for us in the future, too, she said. We've got white-tailed deer, but they're getting quite old. Her boss said there is no such thing as stealing ideas in the zoo world, just a friendly spirit of cooperation to create a rising tide that lifts all boats. Schellenberger, 58, said quality zoos such as Scoville and her own have much to offer visitors. There is always that wow factor with seeing animals up close, she said, and by doing that, and by showing how we care for those animals, I think it allows us to demonstrate how we should all treat each other with compassion and respect. And an article from Valerie Wells, staff writer for the Herald and Review, from Decatur, MacArthur Jr. cheering all the way to London. Maddie Taylor is not discouraged by failure. The MacArthur High School junior is a cheerleader and a dancer, and when she tried out for the All-American cheerleading squad at cheer camp a year ago, she didn't make it. Undaunted, she tried again this year and found success. In December, she'll go to London to appear with the squad in the New Year's Day parade. She'll be accompanied by her mother, though her dad will stay home to look after the family pets. I'm a nervous mom, said her mother Janice. I would worry all the time if she went without me. The audition at this year's cheer camp in Peoria required the girls to learn a routine in one day in small groups and perform it for judges. Maddie said her dance and cheerleading background helped, but the pressure was still on. Only 6 girls from each squad get to try out for it, Maddie said. She won't get to practice with the All-American squad until she gets to London because members live all over the United States. She has a DVD to work with, but she said she's not worried. She takes dance at Studio B, every style including jazz, tap, and ballet. She also belongs to the National Honor Society, serves as Freshman Academy mentor, member of the Chemistry Club, and takes 3 advanced placement and 2 honors classes at MacArthur, and has performed more than 100 hours of community service, although only 24 are required to graduate. She manages a lot of challenges at the same time. Mom and daughter plan to do some sightseeing while they're across the pond. Janice Taylor has been to London before, but this will be Maddie's first visit. I'm afraid of heights, but I really want to go on the Millennium Wheel, Maddie said, referring to the giant Ferris wheel, also known as the London Eye. And an article from Eureka, written by Lenore Sobota. Eureka's Ivy Tradition welcomes students. A bagpiper, bits of ivy, and even fist bumps were all part of a tradition convocation at Eureka College on Tuesday, designed to inspire and welcome new students to the school founded in 1855. With a light breeze rustling leaves in the trees surrounding the Rinker Outdoor Amphitheater, 262 new students, 166 of whom are freshmen, were led to their seats by a bagpiper playing Scotland the Brave and faculty in full academic regalia. Each student carried a sprig of ivy. Students put their ivy into a basket near the end of the convocation, symbolizing formal membership in the Eureka College community, according to the convocation program. The ivy ceremony goes back to 1925. President David Arnold told the students, "Our relationships, like the ivy, grow stronger over time because we become entwined with one another." At commencement, graduates will cut a circle of ivy as a reminder that ivy can take root elsewhere and as a symbol of the spread of knowledge. Freshman Christina Thurman, a kinesiology major from Roberts, liked the ceremony, saying, "The ivy made us come together." Junior Brittany Shaw, a transfer student from Bartonville, majoring in elementary education, said the convocation made me feel welcome and part of the school. But the convocation was more than a welcoming event. Students also were challenged to make the most of their opportunities. Erica Quinn, Associate Professor of History and 2015 recipient of the Helen Cleaver Distinguished Teaching Award, delivered the main address. She noted that in 2014, 30% of the United States population had an undergraduate degree, and their incomes were 60% greater than those with only a high school diploma. But she added, "Most of your professors hope it's more than the bottom line that brought you here and will keep you here." Outlining a history of campus activism, Quinn said, "Students have power and the ability to recognize injustice and be outraged by it." Dean of Admissions, Kurt Kreil, told the students, "You are embarking on a new journey, one with opportunities for personal growth in and outside of the classroom." Tuesday was Kreil's 28th opening convocation, but this one took on a special meaning for the Eureka College graduate. His daughter, Taylor, was among the freshmen. "I am so glad to share this day with her," Kreil said. Taylor Kreil got a hug from her father as she and other new students walked through a reception line of college officials at the conclusion of the convocation. The rest of the students received handshakes, high fives, or fist bumps from Kreil, Arnold, and other administrators. One student bounded toward his friends after going through the reception line, telling them, "I like that. That was fun." Students weren't the only ones smiling, so were the college officials. Enrollment figures won't be official until the 10th day of classes, but preliminary numbers indicate a total enrollment of about 695, up from 664 last year. The high was 782 5 years ago. On-campus housing is nearly at capacity. Provost Daniel Blankenship said the school is happy to have a good freshman class. "It's a very competitive place in higher education today," he said. An article from Decatur, written by Emily Steele, Herald and Review staff writer. Lutherans train for disaster response. It's not in the disaster response book, but if you're lucky enough to have GPS after a tornado hits, don't use the version that shows you how the street looks. It's confusing when you see a pile instead of eight houses, Stephen Bourne said. Bourne is a volunteer disaster response regional coordinator with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and led a six-hour volunteer training session Saturday at Lutheran School Association. More than 30 people were trained how to prepare for responding to a disaster as a member of the volunteer Lutheran Early Response Team. Everyone involved with the agency is a volunteer, so all donated funds go to supporting disaster victims. "That's a good thing because it's dollar in, dollar out," Bourne said. The response team had its start in Decatur 2 years ago when 28 people were trained at LSA. A little more than 2 months later, a tornado struck Washington, Illinois, and they were called to action. Jennifer Don was part of that first team. There she created a team of comfort dogs and eventually decided she wanted to bring one to Decatur. Don is now president of the nonprofit Paw Print Ministries and its three comfort dogs who are deployed with Lutheran teams to give people a moment to relax and forget the chaos around them. "We have a lot of demand and I never want to turn anyone away," Don said. Since then, the Lutheran teams have grown to 400 volunteers that cover 51 counties. They have responded to tornadoes in Moquegua, Rochelle, and Quincy, as well as floods in Waseca. They also have a disaster response trailer, trained chainsaw tree removal crews, counselors, a response vehicle, and Paw Print Ministries. "The word is spread," Bourne said. "We're trying to create pockets of teams within every county. It's even brought in more congregants in the areas they work." After a disaster, volunteers who can go arrive in the area and work out of a local church. Typically, the teams will come in a few days after the first responders have done the initial work and provide ongoing support with basic first aid, counseling, food, debris cleanup, as well as taking requests for work from homeowners. The teams stayed in Washington for 8 months after the tornado. Bourne said some companies try to take advantage of disaster victims. They're waiting for you to ask for donations or to preach, but you're just going to do your work, Bourne said. Mercy is the core of their mission as a branch of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The response manuals each volunteer received is titled Mercy in Action. We provide assistance FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, cannot. Spiritual care, Bourne said. Once they've done their part, they leave. Participants came from all over Central Illinois for the training. How to interact with people, I think that's what's important, Aaron Rhodes said of the training he attended with his wife, Deanna. They drove from Paris to attend. Both work in the medical field. He's an optometrist and she is a dental hygienist. And with his experience with the area American Red Cross, felt called to help others by learning more. You can use it for your own knowledge during a disaster, Deanna Rhodes said. And from Mount Zion, an article written by Emily Steele, Overdose Awareness 5K Bears Hope. Each purple balloon released into the sky represented someone's battle with drug addiction. Some bore messages of hope, while others had the name of a loved one who died from a drug overdose. Inside the Mount Zion Lions Club, poster boards reading Gone Too Soon were covered with pictures putting faces to those names. About 150 people participated in the third annual Overdose Awareness Day 5K Run and Memorial Saturday, which organizer Mike Burkham said raised about $15,000. That money, for the Tyler Yount Foundation, will go back to the community in the form of drug overdose kits for first responders, family, and friends of addicts, as well as a scholarship for someone completing probation through the Macon County Hybrid Court. Burkham and his wife Kathy started the foundation to raise awareness about overdose deaths and reduce negative stereotypes surrounding them in honor of their son Tyler, who died from an overdose. After the race, Burkham, as well as representatives from Heritage Behavioral Health Center, law enforcement, and the hybrid court, spoke about the state of drug abuse locally and statewide and their efforts to curb drug abuse. Recovering heroin addict Troy Pulliam also spoke, admitting he was a little nervous. "It's not the public speaking, it's all the police officers," he added. His probation office, judge, and mother were added to his list, getting a laugh from the audience. "It's good to be in a room like this and not be worried about it." Pulliam told his story of 21 years of drug abuse that eventually led him to choosing between 8 years in prison or going through the hybrid court. He chose the court's intensive probation that led to his recovery and now said he feels no shame sharing his story, for which he received a standing ovation. "If I can help one person by telling my story, it's worth it," Pulliam said. Burkham said the foundation's first scholarship is currently in progress, helping a man to earn a welding certificate. He echoed what Pulliam said about addicts needing to change their whole lifestyle and group of friends to help their recovery. "When people get the clean to get them on the right track, you have to give them something to work with," Burkham said. He knows there's a lot riding on him. an article from Decatur, written by Allison Petty. Tree removal opens lake views. Travelers passing across the South U.S. Business 51 Bridge can now enjoy a much better view of Lake Decatur, thanks to a tree removal contract that wrapped up last week. The $87,500 project was part of the city's ongoing effort to open up public vistas of the lake, said Keith Alexander, the city's director of water management. The Decatur City Council awarded the contract in June to Clean Sweep Tree Service. Alexander said the council in 2007 wanted to begin clearing trees and brush from embankments, and $50,000 was set aside in the water department's annual budget for that purpose. The amount was doubled in 2013. The latest effort encompassed the area from Fisherman's Wharf Park along the shoreline to Lake Shore Drive, past its intersection with Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. Previous projects included Lost Bridge Road in 2013 and 2014, Williams Street Road in 2012, Lake Shore Drive in 2011, US 51 in 2009, and Reese Bridge Road in 2007. With these types of projects, we have to rotate and go back to areas that we've done before to prevent the overgrowth from occurring again, Alexander said. He said the contractors apply herbicide to kill tree stumps, but do not prevent the return of other vegetation, which prevents erosion. Select trees are allowed to remain. Lake Maintenance Supervisor Joe Nyheiser marks the chosen ones before the projects begin. Nyheiser said he evaluates the location, species, and health of the trees, attempting to preserve a variety. In particular, oak trees, red maple trees, locust trees, and sycamores are generally good choices, he said. Nyheiser hopes the city will be able to tackle the south side of the US 36 bridge next year. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, August 31st, 2015. Please stay tuned.